You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Māori grievances about land are historical. We didn't wake up in the 1970s all angry and protesty and, you know, started demanding our things back.
The Wire. This morning I came across a post by Annette Sykes on Facebook. She's a long-time lawyer and activist for Tino Rangatiratanga and one of the lawyers who defended those accused initially with charges of terrorism following the Te Ruweta raids in 2007. Those charges were eventually dropped. Sykes was referring to legislation being debated under urgency by Parliament regarding the COVID-19 Public Health Response Bill. On the parliamentary website, it says this bill establishes standalone legislation that provides a different legal framework for responding to COVID-19 over the next 2 years or until COVID-19 is sooner brought under control. This passed the first and second readings last night without support from National. The clause Sykes drew attention to read as Section 20, Article 3, quote, a constable may enter a private dwelling house or marae without warrant only if they have reasonable grounds to believe that people have gathered there in contravention of a Section 11 order and entry is necessary for the purpose of giving a direction under Section 21, end quote. Now, this morning, as the debate continues in a committee of the whole House stage of the bill passing process, it's become clear this clause was not well received, both by public and in the House. First, though, a little explanation on the political process itself. Basically, a bill usually has a bunch of stages. First reading, select committee, which has public submissions. Second reading, which has potential votes on changes suggested at select committee and through select committee reports. Then you have the committee whole house. Any member can put forward a supplementary order paper, which amends or edits parts of the law. And then you have the third reading. The Governor General then gives royal assent, because we still remain a colony, and signs into law bills that have been passed by the House. Government bills are pretty much guaranteed numbers of votes for all stages, because they have the numbers to introduce them. Members' bills are different and they can fail at any of those stages. So with those stages, you can see we've jumped from those initial readings, skipping the select committee process and going straight to the committee whole house stage. And the committee of the whole house stage is where amendments can be made. For example, the ACT Party's David Seymour put these supplementary order papers in, asking for amendments such as remove an overlap of power that remains between the powers of the Minister of Health and the Director General, limiting the power of the Director General and protecting the safeguards placed around ministerial responsibility for enforcement orders. Also, introduce a safeguard against abuse of power by creating an accountability mechanism for enforcement officers who are engaged by the Director General to enter premises, shut down businesses and issue fines. Also, establish that the law should be in place for 1 year rather than two to allow a proper parliamentary process to take place. I'll say here too that Seymour initially supported the bill, but he has now removed his support. Now, supplementary order papers are regularly put up during the committee whole house to delay debate or to make political points, even and especially when MPs know they might fail. So through a motion to the House, you can delay this process or at least make it more difficult. In urgency, you don't have a select committee. And having a shortened select committee would be a bit difficult here because it means people have less than 24 hours to put forward a supplementary order paper, given that we are moving into level two tonight. Unless we have law in place by midnight tonight, the level two lockdown is unenforceable legally. So let's keep that in mind as we continue the discussion. Now, the National Party put up a lot of SOPs this morning, and MP Alfred Ngaro criticised the speed of the process as well as criticising the powers granted through this bill, and has touched on the specification of marae in the initial wording of the bill. We're going to hear from Alfred Ngaro now.
Mr Chair, that's exactly the point. While I acknowledge the changes that have been made through the SOP, the point is, when you have a reference point, you can then determine the decisions so that you don't make the mistakes to try and change them or to try and define whether you need further consultation with others around. Why? Because you're guided by the determination of the principles that are here. Can I remind us in the House, not just the Attorney General, that the Treaty of Waitangi is based on a principle of a word called kawanata, not just partnership. Kawanata is about a covenant. And here's what it clearly states. And here's the reasons why I think that's important. Because a covenant, and it is, in the meaning of kawanata, is a covenant, a testament, a charter, a contract. It's an undertaking that binds parties into a permanent, moral and irrevocable relationship. That's the reasons why we have it. And at the heart of a bill that's coming before this House, and again, we don't challenge the what. We know what needs to happen. We're challenging the why. And what I'm challenging here today is this, that at the heart of this relationship, which is the foundation of this nation, of two peoples that are reflected in the covenant relationship, why was it not taken into account? You can change the deck chairs, you can change the SOPs to make it look like it appeases people, but at the heart of it, you've forgotten the principles that are critically important. And I say this to the House. I say this to the history and the heritage of this place, because we're all accountable. But I'm now saying to you that is in charge, to you that is in a position where you are in charge of this bill, if you cannot uphold a covenant relationship between Māoridom, then I say this to you and to the nation of New Zealand, then you're not upholding a relationship of trust with the people of New Zealand. Because that's what it goes to the heart of. If you cannot understand the key principles of what that means, sorry, Madam, Mr. Chair, didn't want to bring you into the debate, but to the government of the day, if you cannot take to account the advice that was given in the exposure draft that the Prime Minister stood in this House, said that was critically important because of the speed of the process, we wanted to acknowledge and to engage, and yet they have been forgotten. Like the funeral directors, like those in the churches, like those in other places around the country, the nation is waking up to see that under this government, it's not the what that people are arguing, it's the how you are going about it. You are giving extraordinary powers. You're going to the point where the goodwill that has been given by this nation to the governance of this country to lead us to a place of safety and well-being is now being trashed and taken away. Mr. Chair?
The Honourable Alfred Nuttall.
Mr. Chair, I want to just finish off my comments there. But I want to say to the Minister, the question is, when did he receive those comments? How did he accommodate the views that were stated? And there are a number of them that were stated in this report that I have before me. How did he accommodate them? Or was it just a casual conversation you mentioned about Willie Jackson? Can I also say, when you use the definition in your interpretation with Marae, that they had dual roles, not only as places of cultural significance, but also as social services. Well, I'd like to say the same thing too. That goes the same for churches. The number of churches that are now having a dual role of not only places of worship, but also places of serving their community through the outreach of social services is right up and down this country. So they are no different at the same time too. So I don't buy the excuse or the reasons that were given that those marais have a dual role. Mr. Chair, I'd like the Minister to answer those questions. I'd like them to take in consideration that was given to him in the exposure draft that was submitted. And again, to answer the question, why is it that those views and those comments were not taken into consideration, and all we're doing now is just trying to tidy up. Just like we got the rubber, we're going to rub it out, we're going to change it, put it in SOP part two, make it look like that accommodates and appeases the people. This is not just for Māoridom. This is for all New Zealand who's starting to wake up that their civil liberties and their civil rights, the goodwill is about to run out. And when it does, you'll see a backlash of people starting to say, enough is enough, Mr. Chair.
That was Minister Alfred Nuttall. Now, I tried to follow Parliament TV this morning, and to be honest, it's pretty confusing. It's hard unless you know how it works and what, you know, the supplementary order means, or Mr. Speaker, you know, why did he say that? And anyway, it gets confusing, I feel. Hence my explanations just now, which were very brief, obviously, and quite basic, but they're worthy in terms of understanding the bill process. Now, on to the specification of marae. Calvin Davis has said this morning's references to police being able to enter marae without a warrant have been removed, and therefore the marae reference in the COVID-19 Health Response Act is due to be removed. However, why was the specification there in the first place? And some have asked, why does it not reference the likes of the local tennis club, for example? Co-leader of the Green Party, Marama Davidson, spoke in the House this morning referencing this.
I call Marama Davidson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am picking up specifically on Part 2, Clause 20, and I've also got SOP 497 in front of me, which relates to those very clauses. I want to pick up the original The reasons why the definition marae has been included in the original text, and I also wanted to ask the Auditor General if that SOP that is now going to remove the words, the definition, the words marae is on the table. I'm just trying to... is that there is a long-standing legal use of having to single out marae because of the differentiation between private dwellings and the grey area where marae fit. And so I understand it was included in that respect, but that in Part 2, Clause 20 in the powers of entry, it singles out marae specifically, originally, to actually overlay an extra threshold of protection and criteria so that warrantless entry can happen, and that we are seeking to remove marae, and I will come to the context of why that too has happened, but that it also then removes those extra layers of protection. So I will just pick up on the Part 2 part of the bill, and something that the Greens absolutely believe needs to be scrutinised, these warrantless powers, and absolutely uphold that there needs to be public conversation, and some of that we've heard just overnight in the community on social media, but that we worked to provide an extra layer of protection around warrantless entry that included for marae needing to have extra grounds or reasonable grounds, and that they would only enter premises if it was necessary to direct people to disperse. There were a number of extra thresholds that were worked on in the original version, in the current version of the bill, and that the SOP, I'm wanting some clarity as to whether those extra protections remain or whether the marae now has the same status as every other venue and place. And I'm hoping that I can address the context of why I also understand why removing the word marae from our perspective is important, because there has been public outrage as to that inclusion of the words, feeling that marae were being unduly targeted in that, particularly in that Part 2, Clause 20 part of the bill, and that outrage acknowledges a long-standing historical, current and colonial context of the justice system being unfairly applied to target Māori communities, brown communities and low-income communities, and that the police themselves have acknowledged that long-standing legacy, and I do acknowledge the ongoing work that they are wanting to do to correct that and to have a different approach. But that is one of the changes that has come through in both, I think, SOP 497, but certainly addresses Part 2, Clause 20, and then I simply wanted to put on record that outrage has come from a particular context and has brought us to some changes which we are seeing today, which I am supporting for that purpose, but that some misinformation has also been drummed up, including by the opposition members, around the meaning and the inclusion of the word marae in the very first place. In my final sort of time left on this particular call, that I understand, again we're going to Part 2, powers of entry, that I understand the reasons and the hardships that people have faced with the interruption to our ordinary liberties. And we've all felt that in many different ways, and particular groups and people and sectors have felt it in big, massive ways, and that we need this legal framework to be able to sit behind alert level 2 and so on and so forth. I do welcome the change to review, and rather than have the 2-year outset sunset clause, that we will actually review at more regular and closer terms. I think that's absolutely something that we all should welcome, and I'm very pleased to see that happen also. But I think just if the Auditor General could explain a little bit more about the inclusion of the word marae.
I call David Park, the Honourable David Park.
Madam Chair, yes, essentially the member is correct in her description, and for the reasons that she's outlined, the combination of these two SOPs is that after, assuming they are passed by the House, if they were to be passed, then Section 20, Subsection 2 then reads, However, subsection 1 does not apply to a private dwelling house, and there is no reference to marae. There is the protection left, which has been inserted at subsection 8, that if marae was entered as a private dwelling house, then, and that's a question of law as to whether it is a private dwelling house. We've had that discussion previously as to there being a number of roles that marae's undertake, for want of a better word. But if it was ever entered as a private dwelling house, then the power that's exercised triggers a requirement to send a copy of the report that has to be sent to someone senior in the place, and the police is also sent to the committee of the relevant marae.
That was Marama Davidson first there, and then David Parker, who wrote the bill, responding to her comments. So yes, back to the bill. I reached out to a number of people this morning to comment on this, both the bill itself, but also what it could mean, how it came about, that sort of thing. And many were still trying to understand the bill itself and follow the debate process. But I did get a written statement from Professor Jane Kelsey of the University of Auckland Law Faculty saying, "This is truly breathtaking. As I read it, I had images of parihaka. The wording almost mirrors that in the West Coast Peace Preservation Act 1882. The assurances echo those in the Terrorism Suppression Act. And sure enough, we had the Uruwera raids despite them all." Jane Kelsey then passed on an open letter she had written to Māori MPs in Parliament, which I read here. "I'm writing to you as Māori MPs with a plea to vote against the COVID-19 public response bill and at the very least refer it to Select Committee for scrutiny. There are so many problems with the bill, but I want to focus specifically on Clause 17, Section 3. As I read the bill, I had images of the invasion of parihaka. The wording almost mirrors that in the West Coast Peace Preservation Act and the arrest of Rua Kenana at Maunga Pohatu. As some of you will recall, I teach both of those to my first year law and society students as among the deepest days of racism and colonial oppression in New Zealand. Surely we can't be laying the ground to repeat those grave injustices in the name of COVID-19. The assurances of safeguards echo those we were given when making submissions on the Suppression of Terrorism Act. Some of us predicted those powers would be used against Māori with sweeping racially biased interpretations and failed safeguards. Sure enough, we had raids on Te Uruwera. As part of the legal team for that case, I was privy to appalling actions of Crown agencies that will never be exposed to the light of day. Just today, we have stories about the police trialling facial recognition software without any permission. We know that AI has inbuilt racial biases. This bill operates for 2 years without effective scrutiny. If the Parliament passes this bill and the Māori MPs are complicit in that, what reassurance does a requirement for ex post scrutiny in the House provide? Where is the Treaty of Waitangi assessment, even against the deeply flawed guidelines adopted by the government last year? And the Bill of Rights assessment makes no reference to the treaty. Clause 17, Section 3 treats a private dwelling in a marae as equivalent, and the concerns expressed are over privacy, not over tino rangatiratanga, tikanga, te kawa o te marae." End of sentence. Yes, there are health issues, but as with the roadblocks, there are means of cooperating to develop appropriate strategies that recognise tino rangatiratanga and are culturally appropriate and recognise tikanga. The Crown is acting today just as it did back in the 1880s. Today it should know better, but by bypassing Select Committee, it is not prepared even to be held to account within its own forum. Please vote against this bill and plead with the government to at least send it to Select Committee to hear submissions." That was Professor Jane Kelsey, and I then touched base with Julia Faipoti, a justice advocate of Ngāti Porou descent, and asked how she felt about this legislation.
Really concerned, actually, about some of the powers that have been passed through this ledge, especially the enforcement powers that are given to police to enter property, and it explicitly referenced marae without a warrant. And it just concerned me that this will have, obviously, disproportionately affect, hurt, particularly Māori, given our historical current relationships with police. And the fact that this has passed through quite quickly without any real apparent or consultation with Māori. Yeah, and I wish I could say I was sort of surprised, but this is extraordinary times, and there needs to be a monitor on extraordinary powers passed here, because the response needs to be proportionate, and this is definitely going to be something that hurts or disproportionately impacts us and Māori communities.
I mean, it's been noted now that the specification of marae is going to be removed, but it was there in the first place. So what's the issue with that?
The inclusion of marae was actually meant to provide a bit of a higher threshold to enter into marae. But actually the existing powers that sat there, from what I could tell from looking at the bill, was that actually police have the right to have no warrant to enter houses and marae, even if they didn't explicitly state that. So the removal of the section that was included doesn't actually remove that power. And so at the moment, police still have the power to go in under this law, proposed law, without a warrant, which into places that include marae. And that's how I still see that, even if they remove this specific wording. They've actually kind of removed an attempt to include a higher protection for marae, but it actually wasn't at all. So it's as it stands, police still have that power, enforcement power. And I think the concern for us, like we're focused on the marae because that's just something that of course was a concern and was quite, I suppose, loud because it was explicitly named. But actually we should have concerns about the ability for them to come into our houses, into the places that, you know, like that we live, into our private places, and not actually need to have a warrant. That's a huge concern for me.
So I guess the kind of crux of the issue here is the speed in which it is happening. And people have pointed out, though, that we move into level two tonight. So it has to be done in order to have a sort of legal provision to actually go into level two.
I absolutely understand and support the need during this time that, of course, legislation is going to have to be passed quickly. I mean, there's bigger problems around how laws generally are passed under urgency or can be used, but this is obviously a very rare and needed time. Engari, the response needs to be proportionate, and I think it shows the absence of having strong Māori voice at the drafting table, at the decision table, because I'm fairly I don't think I can be certain, but confident that they're wanting to pass through laws that are actually here to protect New Zealand during this time. But the impact on Māori is something that clearly was not at the table when this was decided. So when decisions get made without us that impact us, and this is going to get passed through and affect us for the next 2 years, the law's going to be in place and even beyond.
That was Julia Faipoti, and I also managed to speak to political commentator Morgan Godfrey to discuss these issues further. I basically am just kind of trying to get people's thoughts or initial reactions to that legislation which is being discussed. So it's the Public Health or COVID-19 Public Health Response Act.
Yeah.
And then there was that initial specific clause around marae, and I know that is being taken out. But I guess I'm asking people, like, you know, why was it there in the first place?
I don't think it makes much of a difference whether marae's in there or whether marae's not in there. Because at the end of the day, most Māori don't live on a marae, so whether a marae gets searched, it's probably immaterial to most Māori people anyway. And we know that if the cops have these powers to just, you know, bust down the door, essentially, that's what the Public Health Act is going to give the police the powers to do, is bust down the door without any permission at all. And we know that most of those doors are going to be Māori ones, whether it's at the marae, which probably won't be, or whether it's in their home, which is, like, much more likely. Because we know, you know, the cops are like 10 times more likely to use a police dog on Māori. We know they're like 5 to 7 times more likely to use a taser. And they'll be just as likely to use search and seizure powers at a disproportionate rate against Māori. So I don't think it makes much of a difference. If anything, I think concentrating on like the marae is a little bit of a distraction.
You're right, the powers to go into a house are also concerning, and these powers apparently are going to stick around for 2 years. So what's the issue, I guess, in terms of passing this so quickly? I know that we move into level two tonight, so if it's not passed effectively, it's not legally, you know, we're not allowed to be in level two.
Yeah, with legislation that you rush through in 24 hours, you're going to get a shitload of mistakes. But it's kind of weird that the Labor government's bringing in an effective police state without any opposition at all. And if you do speak up, you know, if you were the Prime Minister, you could simply say, say Simon Bridges opposes you, you could say Simon Bridges supports the virus. And then he's going to shut his mouth, which is a good thing, and you should do. But at the same time, you know, you kind of have to worry, or at least if you're Māori, I think you have to worry, if you're Māori or a Pacific person, or anyone who's more likely to be subject to this, then you probably have to worry. Like, on the whole, it's a good thing. The government needs these powers. Like you say, we can't move to level two unless the legislation is passed. But at the same time, why do the police need the powers to enforce it rather than, say, health officials, DHBs, the Ministry of Health? I think it's a little bit of overreach to give the cops so much power to do this.
I don't know if you know this in terms of the ins and outs and details of legislation, but, you know, we're moving from, or we have been in level four, which probably there were actually far more powers accessible, and that was effectively, that happened fairly quickly as well, and we basically had an all-powerful government for however long we did. So I don't know if, would you want to comment on that?
It's kind of weird, isn't it? The government told us to stay home for 4 weeks and we all listened. 12 months ago, that would have been kind of an unthinkable thing to happen. But, you know, the virus changes how people look at the world and probably changes how important we see the state, and also at the same time how problematic we see the state as being or the Crown as being. Because, you know, lockdown, those 4 weeks weren't a pretty little holiday for most people, or for a lot of people, those 4 weeks lockdown were tough. It was tough financially, it's tough emotionally. And the people who bear those burdens are always vulnerable people. If you're wealthy and secure and you can lock down with, you know, good income, good family support, you're all right, you're all good. That's a pretty good 4 weeks. But the people we don't hear from are those vulnerable people who probably had a pretty shit lockdown, had a pretty shit level three, and could possibly have a pretty shit level two if the cops get the powers that the government want to give them. Sorry, I just did not answer your question.
No, I think that's the thing, though, is like it's all happened really, really fast. And I don't think that, you know, at any of these stages, there would be quite a small amount of people who were really aware of what was going on. And I think, I mean, that's partly too because the system in which the kind of democracy operates is really confusing.
Yeah. The law that the lockdown was passed under is about 50 years old. I think it might be over 50 years old. And it hasn't been triggered before. This is the first time it's been triggered. And it was triggered so we could enter level four, or so the government could lock everyone down. But the Court of Appeal was probably going to say that, in technical terms, that lockdown was ultra vires, which essentially means the government didn't have the power to do it. It'll get appealed to the Supreme Court, and I'm sure the Supreme Court will agree as well that the government overstepped its powers. But I think most New Zealanders would be like, I don't care.
Right.
It was a good thing. Like, they may have broken the law, but at the same time, if you're breaking the law to save potentially thousands of lives, I don't think many people are going to lose any sleep over that.
I guess just to finish up then, what do you suggest, or do you have any thoughts on how this could be done better, or what we might need to move towards in the future?
Honestly, I think this is a revolutionary moment, because I think we see the system, for how fragile it is, whether it's like supply chains in supermarkets or whether it's the way that the Crown treats New Zealanders differently, how some New Zealanders get the benefit of the doubt and how other New Zealanders don't get the benefit of the doubt. So if you're passing legislation and your first instinct is to say that the police can conduct a search and seizure on a marae, that reveals what kind of priorities the Crown has and how the Crown actually views Māori people and how it doesn't view the treaty. You know, if you viewed Māori as full New Zealanders, and if you viewed like the treaty as a document where Māori and tangata te tiriti are like equal, then that would not be your first instinct to give the cops the powers to bust down a marae. So I think it's a very revealing moment. I hope people can see it for what it is.
Do you want to add anything else?
Abolish prisons too.
That was Morgan Godfrey. So, whānau, that's all the coverage I have on that today. And as I understand it, the bill is still being debated, or at least voted on, in the House. And I suggest we all keep an eye on how this progresses. I have had a couple of messages in. We had somebody calling and saying, if you've got nothing to hide and you've got nothing to worry about, the cops visiting. And somebody else, though, saying it's undemocratic to rush a conversation that places major controls over the lives of New Zealanders for 2 years. I have the same problems with this bill that I did with National Strike Force Raptor. You're putting major control into the hands of a police force with seemingly complete trust that police will behave in a just way when I have stories of police abuse against close friends. It doesn't work collaboratively with the public and Māori. It's unfortunate to see this government that has built a great deal of trust with the public over this pandemic try to push this so quickly. We'll be back just after this.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.